So, welcome to the show. Once again, I'm your host, Sully. We have another great filmmaker on here. You might have seen many of his work for Full Moon Entertainment. He has worked with Tim Thomerson on Asylum of Darkness and Live Evil. He has also produced, directed, written, and composed music and for many documentary series and TV shows and B pictures. You might have seen everything from him, from Paranormal State to Lost Tapes and Ghost Lab. He's currently working on various other short films and independent pictures. We have the one, the only, Jay Wolfel.
Thank you. I think that sounds like my resume, so it must be me.
Well, so you've toured a bunch of festivals, including the Philip K. Dick Film Festival and Academy of Science Fiction and Horror. What have you been up to lately in terms of the festival scene post-COVID?
The COVID like shut all that down. I was all set and invited to go back to the Austin Science Fiction Film Festival. It's really science fiction horror, outer worlds, I believe they call it. It used to be Other Worlds. By the time I started going, it was Other Worlds and Outer Worlds. It's science fiction and horror.
Yeah, it was confusing.
yeah, exactly. So I was all set to do that, and then COVID happened, and they said, why burn the festival when we're just going to do it online? Let's wait till we do it in person again. I've been out of that loop, but I should be back there probably this year, 2023. You mentioned the Philip K. Dick Film Festival. I met the Austin guy through Philip K. Dick back when I was showing Asylum of Darkness there, when I think it was still Season of Darkness.
Oh, sweet.
Probably in like 2013 or 2014. And then later, as sort of a personal thing to do, I do music for other people's movies and also my own. I decided I'd try to find a film which had never had music done for it. Not necessarily a silent film, because people use silent films as kind of concert works now, mm-hmm. Which is cool. And I've gone to a bunch of those over the years. And so I finally decided to, during COVID, really before COVID, but I just decided to start looking for something to do. I ended up scoring Island of Lost Souls, the Bela Lugosi movie, which then Austin showed on a big screen, and a lot of people had never seen the movie and they really loved it. And from that, I got to meet the Lugosis. Bela's son, Bela Jr., is still alive.
Oh, that's so unreal. That's neat.
Yeah. And then Lynn Lugosi, his granddaughter. So I knew these people were alive and around. And then I met Sarah Karloff because I scored The Old Dark House. And then I met Ron Chaney, who I'd actually met before all this, who's Lon Chaney Jr.'s grandson. So I kind of got to know all these sort of living. So I'm like, all the biggest stars of 1931 are, I'm in their pocket and they're in mine, you know.
Everybody's happy. That's
yeah, but I never expected to, have personal, connection, and friendships with these guys through doing this. I just thought it would be an interesting challenge to, work, on a movie that nobody had ever done a score for, something great. And, how else am I going to get to work with Charles Laughton and Bela Lugosi, So that's become a whole sort of parallel, I hate to use the word career, but mm-hmm. parallel endeavor. And because of that, that sort of got me back into festivals, because I'd sort of given up on festivals as a pursuit. Because the big thing about festivals is you want a festival that has an audience, because you've already seen the movie, so you don't need to go sit in a room and watch it by yourself.
And it was getting really annoying how some of them were like, well, we can't nominate you or talk about it or show it if you're not in attendance. I'm like, well, that's unrealistic. Not everyone, some people have day job and they're struggling filmmakers. What do you say to them then?
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, but that sort of drugged me back into doing that. I ran the festival circuit with Asylum of Darkness because my previous movie that closed for the season, now known as Carnival of Fear, which it was always known as overseas. I've lost my train of thought. But while Carnival of Fear got released,
you guys can find it on Tubi, by the way.
Oh yes, please do. a number of my movies are on there, actually, including movies I've edited for other people. But anyway, that film had just come out, and Asylum of Darkness I was still working on, so I wasn't interested in competing against myself. You know, I had one film that just came out, so the other film I basically decided, okay, I'll go back and submit to festivals and do that whole thing. And Asylum of Darkness did get into some festivals, which then led to the Austin thing kind of, you know, years later. So it's kind of like, as soon as you give up on festivals or don't pursue them, then suddenly, you know,
it's hard to get that traction back. I know.
Yeah. Right. But I actually got the traction back without seeking it. The Austin thing, I won best score for. I thought they were just showing the movie. I didn't really know I was in competition.
I was a fan of you just because you're so heavily featured in the Live Evil special features. You were able to record the, you know, the panels that you did at the convention scene, and you just came off as just a really just, you know, upbeat dude who just is like, hey, you know, I'm in the same pickle as all y'all. Let's just make a movie, have fun doing it, and you know, who cares about negative press? Just, you know, if you're a pro, you're a pro.
Thanks. That thank you.
And Thomerson provided the right amount of humor, where he's like, hey guys, you're here to see a fun lowbrow movie. We saw a mother walk out because we killed a mutant baby, and this is like, they're at the wrong movie already, clearly.
Yep. No, that, yeah, Tim, yeah. Tim, I met him at a screening of Dollman versus the Demonic Toys.
Nice.
And afterwards, we all went out to eat and chatted with him. And then probably that same year, maybe the next year, I opened my door to go out of my building, get in my car. And Tim Thomerson was standing on the other side of it, holding a sort of like smallish kitchen table upside down by the legs. And he had his like phone and some other stuff like on the bottom side of the table, which he was using kind of as like a carrying thing. And as he like, so he, and it's a kitchen table, and this is a regular sized door, so he's out there trying to figure out how to open the door, and I'm like, Tim, we met before, and let me get you the door. And he's like, oh no man, I don't need help. And then he like dumps all the stuff he has on the ground accidentally. And so he lived in my building, apartment building, for probably at least 4 years.
That's wild.
So that's how, so I already knew him, and yeah, so that's how we really got to become friends, was he'd be down at the pool and I'd be walking out to my car, and then I wanted him to be in my movie Iron Thunder, which he lived in my building by that point, but he was down in Mexico working on some Fred Dreyer TV show.
That makes sense. Yeah, Fred had a lot of syndicated shows in the late 90s trying to get that Hunter money.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then the next movie I did, Unseen, he was back, and I showed him Iron Thunder, and he's like, oh man, I would have loved to have been in this. And so since then, he's been in a number of movies of mine. And Live Evil, I was sort of the contact to try to get him in that movie. Part of the reason why I got to make that film was because I knew Tim Thomerson, and they had no luck getting to him or getting in a movie. Virtually every movie I've done with Tim, virtually, I'm not exaggerating, or if I am, very little, every one of those, he's been like, oh, this is my last movie, I'm retiring. This is my last movie, I'm retiring.
Until I want to do a movie where I'm, you know, a demon slayer.
Right, yeah. Now he's told me since, he goes, well, I'll do a movie for you, but otherwise I'm retired, which he's kind of like, you know, he's sort of stuck to that one at the moment anyway.
But and I remember you being interviewed in a cool, like, indie filmmaker book. There's like a few different ones by the guys who had, oh, what's his name, who had, were totally just doing do-it-yourself book, and you were asked, you know, about your various Richard Hatch movies, you know, Battlestar Galactica fame, and just, you had just some cool advice on just like, hey, you know, make use of that limited budget, and you know, and just have the film crew be small, because you know, otherwise, you know, there's going to be too many cooks in the kitchen. It was just neat.
Yeah, no. When I moved to Los Angeles, you know, I came from Ohio originally. This most recent film I did in Ohio again, and I've done some other films there. But I've lived in Los Angeles since 1990 and worked here. So when I first moved out here, you know, I got to go on, I believe it was a Full Moon set. Later, I went on a Roger Corman set. And so I didn't know what you know, what a low budget Hollywood movie, you know, was going to be like. And it looked pretty much just like a big budget Hollywood movie in terms of they had like a lot of people walking around. The sound stages were more decrepit. But a sound stage is always just sort of a decrepit big hole you build stuff in. But I was just kind of like, well, they're renting soundstage space and they got a lot of crew, you know. And so what I quickly found out was that the way they save money on making low budget movies in LA was just to like shoot less days. So you still had like a crew of, say, 50 people. You just only got to shoot back then. You got to shoot for 18 days.
Yeah.
That was, a low budget movie was 18 days. TV movies were 18 days. That was the low budget professional shoot schedule. Pretty quickly, like within 6 months or a year of that time, it became 15 days. Like another year after that, it became 12 days. And it's just shrunk and shrunk to like, you know, asylum movies. Some of those are literally done in 6 to 9 days. There's CG stuff afterwards, but the actual shoot is just like this brutal, you know. An asylum came up on labor board charges because they were working people so hard and for so long that the salary they were paying people was, you know, illegal. But yeah, I preached, and I guess you heard that. Yeah, when you're making a movie, like you don't need all these, you know, get the people you need, you know, don't have some huge crew and then have to shoot a movie in such a short amount of time that you really can't make a movie or make anything that's really good. You don't have any time to do, you know, to fine tune it or get the coverage you want to really make it a movie that's going to engage somebody.
Absolutely. And life is short. So yeah, just don't put yourself in that position.
Right. You know, like Sam Raimi, who's, you know, his movies have always had huge, long schedules. Evil Dead, I think, shot for like 100 days or something. Of course, when you shoot a low-budget movie, sometimes your day, your day might be short because somebody's working, so you get to shoot with them for, you know, 4 hours that night. But still, that gives you time to, like, you know, if you shoot for a long... I mean, look at it this way. Like, if you're shooting a movie in 9 days or you're shooting a movie in 20 days... and two of those days are just kind of disasters, the camera breaks or whatever. Like, look at the proportion of the shoot that's going to be screwed up on a 9-day shoot if you have 2 days where you have some problems you can't control. Like, it rains instead of, you know, there's no room to like correct those mistakes. So that's just part of when you have a longer shoot, you can absorb disasters better.
Plan for it because it will happen. And
right, exactly. So, and my big thing too was like, I'd watch people's low budget movies. I still see this to this day. It's like, you know, five people in a bar or in a kitchen. It's like, I don't want to be stuck with these five people in a bar or a kitchen for 90 minutes. Let's have, you know, three people and let's move them around. You know, people always talk about Jaws. It's like, you know, half of that movie is three guys on a boat. You know, but they're out in the ocean and, you know, with all this spectacle. So you don't need all these actors like cluttering up the screen. You know, great movies, you know, Lawrence of Arabia. That movie's really about Lawrence, really. The other characters come and go very, very briefly. That's Omar Sharif. You know, I mean, the number of characters you really care about, focus on, and remember in any movie, regardless of the budget, is a pretty small number. I see people who write these scripts and they just have like people after gobs of people.
And they didn't make any use of them. And it was just like frustrating because you're just like, okay. And trust me, you know, I now have my list of indie filmmakers I will not work with. There's a lot of bullshitters here in Dallas, Texas. And it's just like, it's a great place to work, regardless, you know, of non-union and everything. But like you say, people got to just put a price on it or just say, I will only work with these kinds of people, and whatever else happens, that happens. But yeah, I've had Joel D. Weinkoop on here and see Courtney Joyner and Utter Full Moon albums. And they've said a lot of the same stuff that you specified, where it's just like, honor your plan and just, yeah, you know, that if there's any script that you stick to, that's definitely one, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it, yeah,
J.R. Bookwalter was the same way. I think he's the one who interviewed you. And...
Oh, okay. No, not J.R. directly. Albright, probably Brian Albright. He's sort of related to J.R. Not by marriage or anything, but
right.
Probably Brian Albright. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm glad you brought up Raimi, because that same deal I always ask every indie filmmaker, because there's a lot of snobs online, and unfortunately, people don't like to use the internet for what it's meant to do, which is sell. And it's just amazing. So what do you like to encourage others who you want to tell, hey, you're not going to get a Christopher Nolan. You're just not. But with digital and everything, you can still create a cool cinematic look. You did that with Asylum of Darkness, where you had some very neat makeup and just a straightforward, demonic possession unleashed, and some cool cameos by, genre people such as Tiffany Shepis in the first, in the very opening, what do you say to those who is like, okay, you're not going to get a Sam Raimi movie either, but you're still going to get a decent, B picture?
The start of it is just try to in Hollywood now, I've been told by people who direct big movies, like every Hollywood movie now, they try to shoot in 25 days. So no matter how much money you have, they're really limiting the amount of time you can shoot.
Yeah.
When you want to go make a movie, give yourself time. For me, 3 to 5 pages a day. Now, you're probably going to be more like 5 and above.
That's good. Yeah.
But try to stick as close to 5 as you can. And when you're doing the schedule, that's still plenty to do. On this film I just did one day was, I think, 12 pages. And I knew going in, I was like, this is a huge day. So give yourself time to make your movie, because you don't have money, but you can hopefully have time, especially if you don't have a huge crew.
Totally.
I mean, that's what you need. That's when the movie's made. Everybody wants to kind of rush through production, because that's when, legitimately, when a lot of bad things can happen. Actors quit, all this kind of stuff. You're totally at the mercy of the world. Police show up, it rains, it snows.
Yeah.
It rains, it snows, your camera busts.
There's some stuff where you might even have to use some stock footage, but you need the stuff that's not as overused. I see some commercials and podcasters that are using very outdated themes. I'm like, dude, that was the first thing you used when you first got iMovie or Sony Vegas. And it's like, it doesn't, everyone's heard of the theme. Find a new theme, remix it.
If you're using stock stuff, music or images, and it's really cool, get it out there in a hurry, because you're not the only person who found that. By the time your thing comes out. But yeah, give yourself time to shoot. Write a whole script. Don't go off and the script's not done, or maybe it's not as good as I'd like it to be. And then when you get into a jam, part of what I think motivated this part of our conversation was, when you get into a jam, if you're trying to hurry and finish the day and all this kind of stuff, it's like rewriting the script is not the first thing you should do. When you wrote the script, you weren't in a jam up against it, out of money, out of love. So try to stick to the script, because usually if you go off of it, you don't get something better. You get something worse.
Now you got 5 more plot holes that open because you omitted that one scene that you need.
Yeah, where you came up with some great idea that, was great at 3 in the morning when you've been up all day, but isn't really great when you try to cut it together.
Right, and now people are putting their stuff on Tubi now that Amazon Prime doesn't allow it anymore. Now there's 5 other indie production companies that are looking for content to buy from.
Right. I wish the word buy actually meant that they paid you money up front.
Yeah, that's the other shitty part too. I've heard so many say they got 20, 50 bucks. It's nothing. Movie's more than that.
Yeah, no, that problem's kind of biting the whole industry in the butt, regardless of budget. You were talking about, pompous. I think in L.A., people who've actually done something tend to be less pompous. I remember telling a class one time, it's like, after you've had your ass handed to you 3 or 4 times, you realize that you're hardly, invulnerable. And you really shouldn't lord it over the monkeys, you know, about how great you are and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing doesn't, I think, happen as much, say, in Ohio or Texas or outside of the sort of industry town where people seem to want to be the best filmmaker in town for some reason. Like, that's like their agenda, is to like promote themselves as being the all capitals filmmaker from Austin or whatever their town is. Mm-hmm. I say they want to be King Dick of Ass Mountain. It's like, this means nothing. Why are you, you know, you should be calling favors. And you know, I got to do a lot of stuff in film school because the guys I met and girls didn't have that kind of attitude of making their movie. We were willing to work together to make movies. And so we all got to make more movies because we crew on each other's things. You know, I wasn't busy trying to be, you know, I'm not going to go work on your movie because I'm a director, you know, so then you're not going to help me on my movie either. And so,
yeah, I had to cut out a lot of those same people. Is like, I'm the best, but oh, you're beneath me. And it's like, dude, none of us have even made it. So don't you go there.
Yeah. Yeah. I just saw some guy on LinkedIn the other day who was posting this thing. Oh, filmmakers should help each other. And
he was already noted for not helping people, probably.
Yeah, well, no, he very quickly proved that he had no interest in helping anybody when I asked him a couple direct questions. He's like, well, I'm not going to tell you everything I've done. It's like, I mean, the things he was offering up was advice that I thought was like 25 years out of date. Things about getting advances, getting advances from foreign territories to fund your movie. Yeah, he'd only done two features. The last one was 8 years ago. So I was just, yeah, you're putting this up there just to make yourself look good, giving us a bunch of advice that's not
practice what you preach. You're gonna go there,
exactly. Part of that guy's resume still doesn't make sense to me. I'm gonna check out, but yeah, I hate that stuff. Live Evil, I had a falling out with the producer because when they ultimately were selling that movie, they got some deal, and I asked what the deal was, and he was like, oh, that's proprietary information. And at the time, I helped the guy, I got the guy, Tim Thomerson, all this stuff I've been completely open about, to help make that movie good. And then he was asking me about distributors and all this stuff, and I told him all the real numbers and all this stuff. Then as soon as he gets a deal, of course, he can't tell me what his deal is. And then I was finishing up a movie of my own at the time. And I said, okay, if you want to like do this, that's fine. But there may come a day when you're going to ask me something. I'm just going to have to go, hey, man, I can't tell you. It's proprietary information. And, less than a month later, I signed a deal on this other film of mine. And who's the first person to come to me asking what the deal is? I said, remember when I told you there may come a time? And he was like, oh, that was totally different. I was like, no, it's all the same.
Either it's the same. It's just the
same. You know, we're just sharing information. You know, if filmmakers can't be on each other's side, then you just have one more, mountain to climb. You know, if you don't share information, the reason not to share information is to try to convince somebody that you got some huge amount of money that,
And I'm an exception.
Yeah. I mean, that might make sense when you're trying to do your next film with somebody. It's always nice to get a budget bump, a salary bump. So yeah, maybe then you go and realistically say, what do you get paid for your last movie? Oh, add whatever. I mean, that doesn't always work. But I'm saying that's at least a motivation to sort of lie about how much money you had. But I see people like lie about how much money they had on their last movie, and the new movie doesn't have as much. So then they go like, well, you're used to too much money, so we're not going to hire you. So you could screw yourself that way too, by being such a big shot that these people literally get sort of afraid. It's like, oh, well, I can't.
It's not cool.
Yeah. It's just, the truth is pretty much always right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming you have some realistic view of the truth, but anyway.
Right. What does truth mean? People are just making shit up. So you've done some other.
I mean, nowadays, the thing is like with computer editing and stuff, there used to be a lot more barriers between, making an indie movie and making a quote unquote professional movie. Because Hollywood and people shot on film, and film was very expensive and difficult to access. Now everybody shoots on video. Let's face it, that's what it all is. HD, it's still video, man. Give me a break. So, you know, the quality.
Kind of like how everyone was saying, oh, Sony Vegas isn't professional, yet no one really uses Avid and the other stuff that started it off anymore. And I know I knew just about every other person who was in, like, doing live shows, and they're like, hey, Sony Vegas is pretty cool, but I can't say that because then they'll label me as an amateur because of popularity contests. It's just like, that's dumb.
Right. Yeah.
Pretty soon people might even start saying Final Cut 10 or Adobe's Amateur Hour just because it's not being used anymore. It's like, well, if it's good, why not use it?
But, you know, we all have access to all this stuff that used to be, you know, Avid charged so much that they basically created a whole industry of smaller companies that could do the same thing because they were trying to price themselves, you know, they're trying to monopolize everything and charge too much so that indies couldn't afford them. So then somebody just came up with a better product for less money.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you could, you know, you can edit films and you can do all this kind of stuff at home on your laptop in pretty much just the same way that Christopher Nolan and the big boys are doing it. And all that stuff used to be just a huge price barrier. You know, you could never, shooting film was hugely expensive. Editing and finishing something was hugely expensive and difficult. And all that stuff's so much easier now to do on a slicker level, you know.
Absolutely.
Especially, you know, with once found footage came in, then, you know.
Yeah.
All the barriers came off, you know.
Right. TV shows like Homicide were doing the whole,
the shaky thing, the handheld thing.
Make it look like it's on a handheld camera, even though it's just been digitally altered to have that look. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. After the fact, they go in and make it shaky.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. What's his name? The TV writer, Moore. He wrote
Ronald D. Moore.
Ronald D. Moore. I met him because I did the Battlestar Galactica trailer with Richard Hatch. Mm-hmm. And that was largely my crew. Those are the guys who shot Unseen Evil, my DP, Scott Spears, Johnny Young, you know, the producer. Those are all my guys who, like, made that.
It was like one of the first fan films in a way. It was a sizzle reel.
I know. Now, recently, some people have told me that. It's like, you worked on the first fan film. And it's kind of like, I guess I did. You know, it was sort of a, I also edited a film that was probably the first crowd-funded movie that seemed outrageous at the time. I was editing for this friend of mine. I got him a producer, and I ended up being the editor on this film. And they ran out of money halfway through. They did manage to get through the rest of the shoot. So they had the whole thing shot, and then they just needed to raise money to edit it. And Will Wheaton was in that movie.
Yeah.
Will Wheaton, of course, much loathed Wesley Crusher on Star Trek Next Generation. And so Mark, the director, was being very, he was a CG guy when I met him originally. He worked on Titanic, the documentary I was doing. So he was very savvy online and was just telling people, woe is me, I ran out of money and all this stuff. And some fan of Will Wheaton came to him and said, you know, Will Wheaton's meant so much to me and my family that I'd like to give you as much as I can to help you finish this movie. Could, I think it was at least $15,000. It might've been more like 20. Would that help you finish this movie? And then Mark basically did crowdfunding. Once he got that money, he got other money. And the people at the time, there were no real tax laws about this. And this was not a traditional way to fund a thing. And Mark went on a number of places afterwards talking about how he did that. But then Battlestar was, people, Richard met at the post office and all this kind of stuff. But when it was done, we were showing this around. And of course, the series was set up.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by four aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
D- Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's going to listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide all across the globe. We are in the U.S., we are in the U.K., we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Hold on. Produced. I said, does that work? Is that a good pitch to go into a network executive and telling him this is going to be the most expensive show you ever did? And Ron Moore says, no, that's a terrible idea. Because when we went in and pitched our version, I pitched that the show was all going to be shot handheld.
Yeah.
And that was going to like, you know, be real free flowing. And they sort of perceived that to mean they could shoot it really fast and it would be cheap and, you know, it'd be cutting edge. I said, but don't you still have to build all these sets and do all these effects and all this stuff? He goes, oh, yeah, of course you do.
That's awesome.
his pitch was the opposite. It was like, no, we're gonna make this pro show for you in this cutting edge way that's going to be cheap but really effective, you know. And so, yeah,
that's at least you had your moment there, you know, and you got to meet them.
I mean, the show was produced in Canada, so with Canadian content, that was pretty much the end of that. You know, Richard Hatch got on it, and, you know, good for him. And they did ask me and Johnny Young, so we took two meetings, one at Universal and then one with Ron Moore. They were basically like, is Richard Hatch crazy? Can you actually work with him? Richard, apparently somebody at Sci-Fi Channel, Bonnie Hammer, I think her name was, like, took a dislike to Richard for some reason. And she was kind of, I think, you know, putting the kibosh on what we were doing. And
it was even weirder. Yeah. Sci-Fi around that time openly even distanced fans, acting like, people don't want quality. It's like, yes, they do.
Yep. No, then, yeah. And then, yeah.
They had people in charge who shouldn't have been in charge. But,
When I first moved to LA, I saw like advanced artwork for that because a friend of mine was working in motion picture advertising. She still is to this day, very big stuff. And so they were doing concept stuff for this thing called the Science Fiction Channel. They had this sort of little yellow alien with an antenna, like holding a television, so you could kind of see part of his head and the antenna sticking up over Science Fiction Channel. I was so excited. You know, when it finally came into reality, which was just shortly after that, I just became so horrified so quickly. Eventually, they did some series that people liked, but then like they did this whole awful series, these god awful CG monster movies, and
yeah,
I don't know where they're really at now. That sort of all ended with Sharknado that got kind of perceived.
Yeah, they started to produce a lot of stuff out of studio, and then it's like they kept killing every other Canadian show they would get. It's like they would start getting good, and then they'd cancel them. I'm like, well, people are going to stop tuning in if you just cancel everything.
But yeah, anyway, so it was just a curious, you know, phenomenon to sort of see that coming around the bend.
Right. Everyone being told you can't do it, and finally they get it done and it takes off like no one could predict. Your earlier movies, Beyond Dream's Door, is now streaming on Freevee, so anyone wants to check that out. That was a big deal, being made by, like you said, Ohio University students. I could never find your earlier movie with Criminal Intent, and I was always a big Joe Estevez fan. He's a friend of the show.
You may finally get a chance. I don't want to jinx it, but some distributor who I've worked with is interested in
was it a briefly sold movie, like VHS release, and then it?
If you lived in South Korea, you could see that movie on VHS.
Distribution no.
Yeah, that movie. Yeah, we got that movie shot, and then the producer hired an avid editor. And I went to see his suite and heard about how great Avid was and saw this wonderful suite with air conditioning and fancy stuff. I told the producer, I was like, you know, you don't need any of this. You don't need an Avid room. It's just a computer. You can put it in any room. And there's other systems that just do the same thing. Can you afford all of this to finish this movie? He was like, oh yeah, don't worry about it. Well, of course he couldn't. So after they finished the first cut, they owed him a whole bunch of money, and the whole movie just like went into the editor's, you know, garage in boxes.
For
a number of years. And then Colleen Meeker, who was the wife of actor Ralph Meeker, film noir guy, the Robert Aldrich movie, Kiss Me Deadly, that's Ralph Meeker playing Mike Hammer. Cool actor, cool movie. Anyway, she ended up picking up the movie thinking it was finished, and it wasn't. And then hired me and the DP of the movie, Scott Spears, to basically edit and transfer the movie. We did all this, and she made it for this Korean buyer who had bought the movie previously and who she liked. And so she sort of wanted to, you know, not have to get burned by this movie. But she hired this sound guy who thought that he could do a quickie mix and sound job. And then, you know, but she wouldn't. I told him, it's like, she needs this movie now. So whatever you give her, you can't take 3 weeks to finish it. It's got to be done now. So there was a very mediocre sound job done on the movie, literally in like one day. And it's pretty good for one day. But it's not good enough to meet any kind of standards anywhere, I guess, other than South Korea. so I don't know what happened with the movie after that. I don't know if Colleen Meeker's still alive.
That's a shame that you had to deal with that.
Distribution company's long gone. But I have the negative to that movie. And maybe now it'll... So it did get finished, and it did get released in a form. But that's the only movie I've ever directed that's not been released in the United States, which is not to blow my own horn, but you know, it ain't easy.
So frustrating. Yeah.
But it ain't easy to make a movie and have it get distributed in any kind of real way. But that's the one of mine that didn't. So you may get your chance to see Joe Estevez in with Criminal Intent. That's all the more I should say about it right now.
Okay, nice. You know, because movies are getting a second chance now. There was this one, I think, that Severin or Shout Factory did, where it's like they took a like 70s kung fu flick that was made in New York, but they didn't have the sound, and they got all these B-movie guys like Cynthia Rothrock and Don Dragon Wilson to provide voiceovers. And it was...
That's Vinegar Syndrome. I mean, Beyond Dream's Door... which Vinegar Syndrome released, that was shot on film originally, but we never cut the negative. So there was no edited negative for the movie. The movie only existed on video. Mm-hmm. So people maybe 5 years ago, probably more like six now, all of a sudden started coming to me wanting that movie to do a re-release of it. It came out, and it came out again, and then it came out in a limited run, like big box VHS version of all things. I never thought I'd have a movie released on VHS again. But anyway, I said, you know, the negative exists. If you want to bring it out, we should transfer it from the negative. But the negative's never been cut, so it will have to be re-edited to match. And Vinegar Syndrome was willing to do that. So that was the first movie they'd committed to doing that on. And of course, that was a lot of work. And sometimes I felt kind of bad about that. But after watching New York Ninja, which is the movie you brought up,
yes,
where they had no script, really, they had no existing dialogue. then they had no script and they had no recorded dialogue. So I really haven't totally figured out how they got the lip sync to be as good as it is. But yeah, they had some movie, they cut it together. It was 2.5 hours or more long. And then they just had to kind of find the movie within all the footage with little or no involvement from any of the people who did the movie originally. So there was nobody
right.
who knew what they were trying to do. You know? So
exactly.
So Beyond Doom's Door, well, that was like walking a park compared to New York Ninja. it kind of reached a point where, yeah, movies were starting to get shot on film and lots of TV series. The negative was never cut. And the only way to really get a good HD version, which is broadcastable, is to work off the negative. But that means having to re-edit the whole movie. And then there's sound. You got to deal with the sound and make sure it syncs up. And so, you know, after a certain point, all the stuff that existed on film was already out there, and there's still these other things that were popular, had a potential audience. There's some software that's now developed that purportedly you could input the edited show and then transfer the negative, and it will sort of visually cue off of things and supposedly can like basically 80 to 90% recreate the edit just automatically.
I've heard of it, I think.
Yeah. So anyway, that's, you know, a good thing because we shot on negative specifically because video formats, of course, the resolution, you know, is so terrible compared to HD now. But negative has got, you know, there's a lot of resolution waiting in there to be discovered if it's transferred from the original film.
Right. And you've worked on a few other, I think, film remasters or been at some film remastered events as well.
The other thing, you were talking about movies that never got done. There was this movie called Fallen Angels or Heartland of Darkness with Linnea Quigley.
Yes.
Shot right after Beyond Doom's Door that just recently came out through this thing called Visual Vengeance, which is a part of Wild Eye releasing. Who have released several of my movies.
Love Wild Eye. They're great.
Thanks. Yeah, Rob's a good guy. He had wanted Beyond Doom's Door, but he couldn't afford to do the transferring the way, you know, I wanted it done. But Vinegar Syndrome only had Blu-ray rights. So when it came to streaming, I went back to Rob because Rob, you know, had wanted the movie and always liked that film to begin with. So he now is handling all the streaming of it. It's on Shudder. I think their deal may have actually ended in January or will end very soon. And then, of course, you can still get the box set from Vinegar Syndrome, although they told me that they expect it to sell out. My deal with Vinegar Syndrome runs out this year. We'll see where the movie goes after that. I haven't been able to do conventions. I have copies. I'd happily go sell single copies so people could just buy them one at a time rather than buy the whole box set. Because I've had people contact me and go, Jay, I really like your movie, but I don't, the other movies, maybe they're good, maybe they aren't, but I don't want to spend the money. I do have copies I can sell directly now. And
that's cool.
I will go to conventions and sell eventually when there are such things again. Because Vinner gave me copies, that was part of their deal, was that whatever copies they gave me, I could sell and do whatever I want with.
Nice.
But yeah, this Fallen Angels movie that they just finally brought out, that was never finished. It took, I think, 32 or 33 years. I told the director, Eric, I said, you realize this movie has been unfinished for more than half of our lifetimes.
Right. And beyond. And
if you started it again, it would be unlikely if you had the same amount of time that it would be done before we were all dead. I mean, that's a long So, yeah.
And but people are now, I think, opening up, like you say, to second chances. You know, there's better versions of every movie now. From there's a Blu-ray released Waterworld. They're now working on a state version of the director's cut of Johnny Mnemonic. People have embraced different versions of Heaven's Gate and even freaking Justice League. So it's like, but people, like you say, are still wanting to see some of these cult movies that they probably would have seen back in the day and when cable TV was big.
Yeah. Well, yeah, some of these things. I always wondered, like, if, you know, camcorder movies, when people started shooting those things, which was not long after I moved to LA.
Even have it be a separate channel, camcorder.com.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah. There should be. But yeah, there is an audience for that stuff now. Like, SOV, shot on video, you know, whatever. Because I wondered when I had to do a couple of those, I was like, is there going to eventually be an audience for this stuff? Because you know, at the time, that was, again, like, you know, oh, you're not shooting on film. Oh, that's not a real movie. It's like, but yeah, there's fans.
There's always been those snobs. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yeah, no, there's an actual, you know, I know in Austin, I don't know if they still do this, when I went to the festival in Austin, somebody told me there's a venue there that they have VHS night, and they literally, like, it's a theater. I'm not sure how big a theater, but it's a theater. They literally, like, the old AV carts in school, you know, which had all the, you know, the gear to come show you a movie or whatever. It's like a cart, and they wheel it out with the VHS deck connected to a television set into the center of the stage, put the cassette in and hit play, and people actually watch the movie that way.
That's awesome. That would be neat. There's still people who do it. I run the show, Emily Dunlop, on Gag Me With a Knife. She still will watch anything that's in her VHS collection. There's still ways to make it even look good on a projector or a 1080 HD screen. It's just, like you say, it involves effort. And I think we just have to, unfortunately, get through some of the people who are lazier. You know, if it's not on 4K or Blu-ray, then they're not going to be able to find it. And it's like, well, then you're gatekeeping. And it's like, there's not. Not everything's going to be able to be in 4K or even on Blu-ray.
No. And people now, I think they really, I mean, I just remember growing up, we didn't have cable.
Some people didn't have the good stuff.
You know, so yeah, there was no, you couldn't record movies. So if you wanted to watch something, you had to stay up late or you go to bed early because you're working the next day or going to class, so you could, like, set your alarm and wake up and watch something. That was the only way you were going to get to see it.
Set the VCR somehow.
And if you, like, yeah, if you, but yeah, this is before VCRs even.
Oh, there you go. And, like, yeah.
But then if you missed it or you fell asleep, you just had to wait. God knows when it would show again. And yeah, VCRs, like, even those, like, the tapes would run out or something, you know. you'd record this movie with commercials, you know, because it was the only way you'd ever have that movie. And some of that stuff, which I did see then or had, it's like I got rid of that VHS or loaned it to somebody, never got it back, and it just, they're gone. So people now who just think, oh, well, I can always stream whatever I want, so why do I need any physical copies, anything? It's like, well, you know, good luck with that. And a lot of streaming sites, more and more of them are going to start to add commercials, so the movies hopefully aren't cut up. I mean, you know, all the sex, violence, you know, the actual movie's still the movie, but you're going to have commercials in it. And yeah, it's really going back to those days when you had to, like, stay up late to hopefully catch something, you know, when it ran, because you couldn't own it and you didn't know when it would be on again. So people are just assuming that all that stuff will be up there. So it's like, oh, I don't need to buy a copy of this. It'll always be there. You know, I mean, that's just not true. I think movies are vanishing, you know, as quickly now or maybe more quickly than ever.
Absolutely. Instead of just assuming there's always something, well, not always.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, oh, put it in the cloud. That's great. Then I don't have to worry about storing it anywhere. Well, then if you really want it, you're going to have to worry because it's not going to be there.
Absolutely. So what drew you to music scores and getting some of your film composing gigs?
When I started doing movies, like anybody, when I started back to festivals again, why we're talking about festivals so much, but when I started submitting to festivals, you had to own the music in your movie to submit it to a festival.
Yeah.
So you couldn't just use all your soundtracks you had at home or all your favorite bands or whatever, you know. So I actually played music, and I we had a couple of organs and keyboards in my house, so I had to do my own music.
Not everyone can do a silent movie and get passed down that.
Right, right. So so that's really what made me do it originally. And then other people liked the music I'd done for my own stuff, and then I'd get hired to do music for their stuff. And then little did I know, of course, the music was all going to go, I learned playing keyboards. And so music now is MIDI, all sampled music. It's all based on essentially sort of knowing how to play the organ, which I did. So again, that was kind of sort of lucky. I took organ lessons. I played the baritone horn in bands for years from like fourth grade on.
Ah, uh-huh, nice.
Part of what interested me in movies was the music in it, because I played in bands. And so, you're playing music that's, my guy's dead long before you were born kind of thing. And, Beethoven, all that stuff's great, but they're not around to make new music. So once you get into that world, you pretty quickly burn through all the sort of accepted classics. So if you like that kind of music, you like orchestral symphonic music, where can you find it? Because concert halls only book the established names, just like they have their stars, just like movies do, and so that was movies. They're this interesting orchestral music in movies, which you watched. So, for me, like Jerry Goldsmith was a real key name. So once I started getting interested, I noticed that he'd scored a bunch of different movies that I really loved, and didn't realize the same guy was doing this music for all these different movies. And so that got me interested in movie music and movies. And so it was always kind of a parallel interest, and just
cheat the system and actually have fun making it.
Yeah. So somebody at some point some reviewer was saying something like, oh, wow, yeah, he's just being like John Carpenter. It's like, well, you can't really just pull knowing music out of your ass because you want to be like John Carpenter. I've seen guys try, frankly. I've seen guys buy a bunch of keyboards and gear and think that they can be John Carpenter. You can't. So it's lucky.
And plus, if John can do it, why does he get off scot-free and we get whipped?
Yeah. So anyway, so it's just lucky that I kind of had that interest and skill, and that movies need the type of music that, they need original dramatic music rather than just songs. I've written a couple of those too. But
did you meet Charlie Band?
Charlie Band, I met first probably at that screen. I think the first time I really met him was at that screening with Tim Thomerson of Doll Man vs. the Demonic Toys.
Oh, nice.
That's probably when I first met him. I think Courtney Joyner introduced me as being his cousin, because that was a screening that was not supposed to be for outside. Then not long after that, I was editing. When I moved to Los Angeles, I became an editor, because everybody can direct, but nobody wants to know how to edit. And most people in LA didn't know anything about video editing.
Mm-hmm.
Just all film editing. In Ohio, in film school, we learned both. Video editing, there was a class taught where you'd shoot on video and edit on video and finish the whole thing. So I knew both film and video. So at the time I moved to LA, that was a real advantage. So I became an editor when I moved out here. And then through editing this film for Jeff Burke called Eddie Presley, I met this guy, Dave Parker. I taught Dave Parker how to edit, working on this movie called Things, which they're still doing.
Sequels, yeah, they're still doing a bunch.
Yeah, the little movie that, and so Parker got a job at Full Moon eventually, and he and I were trying to sort of, break through and get in there and like get become writers and directors, on our own. So he was kind of the inside man, at Full Moon. Courtney Joyner was working there. He knew and liked, and we still all know and like each other. He helped some, but really it was the fact that I had like a full-time inside guy there. And so we started trying to pitch and write. We wrote a sequel to Seed People, and eventually got the writing gigs, Dave eventually got to direct there too. And so did I, although Full Moon came and went through several, collapses. So that's how I got to meet Charlie Band.
Sweet.
And also, it not really through, but also Dave Dakota, who goes way back with Charlie, he, through somebody else who'd worked on Beyond Dream's Door, I got Dave Dakota's number, and I think I talked to him on the phone, or I might have went out and had lunch with him sometime. He knew Jeff Burr and those guys also. So he came to a screening I had of a short film I did called Come to Me Softly, which is an extra on the Vinegar Syndrome version of Beyond Dream's Door, because it was actually edited into Beyond Dream's Door at one point to make the movie longer. When it first came out, the distributor wanted more time. So Dave Dakota, I had a public screening of that along with some other filmmakers. Again, I teamed up with some other filmmakers, and we all rented a theater and showed our movies together one night. So we all got, you know, more press and crowd off each other's films. And Dakota came to that and liked it. He didn't actually talk to me afterwards, so I didn't know if he hated it. And then through Courtney Joyner, I met him on the set of Puppet Master 3. And he goes, "Oh, I really liked your movie, by the way." So Dakota was also sort of a voice of, why don't you hire this Jay guy when Dave didn't want to do something? My name would come up from time to time at Full Moon. So it was a long process of, you know, meeting Charlie for the first time, a couple of times before it sort of took.
Gotcha.
So yeah, this stuff, you know, people say, "Oh, it's who you know," and all this stuff. It's like, yeah, so get to know somebody. You can, you know, go to screenings, go to festivals where they're at, you know, talk to them, ask them questions about their work, know their work. Don't just go up vomiting your own resume on somebody. And, you know, "Hey, I'm going to be in LA," or "What if I move to LA?" And, you know, all these kind of things. I mean, this stuff really does work, you know, but it's not instant. You know, it doesn't happen.
No, never.
And development people are very difficult to deal with, because a lot of those positions are transitory. So by the time they might read or look at your movie, they may well be moving on to another company or got fired from that one. With Roger Corman, that's what I found out. So I was trying to get in with Roger also. There was this guy there who was a development guy. When I moved to LA, I had a feature that had just come out on video, made for very little money in the United States. And this was a big, like, "What? You made a feature which is in release right now, you know, on your own?"
Yeah, I need you.
I need you. So yeah, they were interested. I was surprised at how much that meant. At Concord/New Horizons, I had a development guy, and, you know, eventually he got to my watched Beyond Dream's Door and liked it, and I started submitting scripts. And right about that time, which was probably 9 months or more maybe into it, like he got offered a higher up job, and they brought in a new development guy, and I just decided I don't want to start over again, you know, with this new guy. Once years later, I went in and pitched some movies to be shot in Ireland, because Roger Corman was over in Ireland producing films at that point. Some of those, I think, ran in his Showtime series. I went in and pitched right when they said, "Yeah, that's a really good idea for Ireland, but we're not going to shoot any more movies in Ireland now." And it wasn't a bullshit thing, because they actually never did again do that. So yeah, it's a long road.
Formulas keep changing, but then you're like, "Damn it, can we be consistent for at least 5 years?"
I know. Well, yeah. Then all the various the digital revolution and the .com collapse. I mean, all of these things seem to just really beat up the film industry. Any excuse to not make a movie, read your script, make your film. You know, any excuse they can find, you know, they will. And this is for any level, I think, you know,
of movie. Right.
So yeah, and you know, life moves a lot faster now, Ferris Bueller would say. And so these trends come and go and burn out, you know, by the time you can like make something you think is trendy, it's already yesterday's news. I don't think you should be chasing some trend, you know.
Yeah. Especially somebody, if it's not class.
Yeah, because somebody other studio is probably going to beat you to it and make a much bigger budgeted, better promoted thing to kind of like rip off whatever the next big hit is before your movie will get there. I mean, I've had some movies like Unseen and Ghost Lake, for that matter, that came out right when horror was starting to get hot again. And both of them did incredibly well because of that. Ghost Lake also caught what was then kind of the zombie explosion, where suddenly zombie films, which were, they were really like a cult outside, you know, no studio ever produced a zombie movie.
And seeing people do it yourself when they were still supporting it at the video stores.
Right, exactly. But no, then like studios started, you know, Walking Dead, all this stuff. So Ghost Lake, although it's not a zombie movie, and some people watched the movie and hated it because it's like, where are the fucking zombies? It's like, well, it is called Ghost Lake, not Zombie Lake, which is a movie, which I'm sure you and I both know. The horror genre is sort of evergreen to a certain extent, but it comes and goes. I mean, right now, certainly in L.A., and not just L.A., the big thing now are these sort of what they call lifetime thrillers, female-driven, like...
Psycho thrillers and stalker.
Yeah, it could be fine, except that these, you know, have no thrills. They're just, most of them are just...
Cheap.
They're like, you know, stale cookies. Yeah, they're the same cookie cutter. And these are all the things that I'm sure Hitchcock's office got 1,000 terrible scripts just like this, like every week. So now they get produced.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, for after horror died, there was this whole thing of erotic thrillers. Then there was sort of a kind of chop socky kind of Cynthia Rothrock. There was that era where that stuff was sort of, you know.
And then just a movie cash in, take two blockbuster movies, put them together, Alien, Dinos.
We talked about Sci-Fi Channel. That was a thing for a while.
And some of that stuff wouldn't even get into sci-fi just because it was shot, you know, in the raw outside. And they're just like, well, we like it, but we can't hear it.
Uh-huh.
Oh, man.
There's a lot of weird rules for those lifetime thrillers. And sci-fi started this, too, where like, because they literally say at Lifetime's like, this is going to be watched by women who are home during the day, like ironing. This is like the 21st century, and there's people working in studios writing this stuff out. So since it's going to be these women at home with their kids, you know, making noise and blah blah blah, you know, the movies have to be set during the daytime, because if it's night and they're watching it in the daytime, it will be hard to see, so they won't like want to watch it. You got to explain things a lot because they'll be distracted again by their kids screaming. I mean, this is the 21st century. This is the brain power behind why these movies have to be made this way.
Any final tips and tricks before we go on how you want to talk to certain people, especially if they got their head up their ass?
Me?
Yeah.
With them?
Because obviously, you know, everyone's got to work on themselves, figure out how to advertise their brand.
Right. I mean, there's certain kind of phrases I suppose you'll hear or start to recognize. You know, you can tell if somebody's actually talking to you rather than just talking at you.
Yes.
And I think you need to be careful to do the same thing. I do know some friends who don't do this with me, but who I see in business situations who seem to be kind of bullying people to hire them, just like vomiting up their resume on people. I even see that work sometimes, but I can't imagine it works that much. And things which have worked better for me is actually showing an interest in people and genuinely becoming friendly or becoming friends with people. Now it's tough to, like, you know, you feel bad, or I feel bad sometimes. It's like, am I just becoming friendly with this person because I want them to hire me? It feels kind of disingenuous. So there's a, but anyway, I mean, if you can become friends with people, then they will hire you. So what, you get a friend and maybe eventually you get a job, you know, is that a fast track to something? I don't know. At least you don't feel terrible about it. But I mean, I've heard it said and I've seen it work that, you genuinely get to know somebody and they'll ask you, you know, I've gotten jobs, which I wasn't trying to get more often than I've gotten jobs I was trying too hard for. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you're too hungry, that is not an attractive, you know, if you're going to eat them up. If you're going to eat your way through them to whatever you need to do, that, you know, I think they'll see that. The other thing you need to do is realize when you're dealing with anybody, to an extent, like doing a production, there's going to be certain battles over certain things. Up front, initially, you need to win some of those battles, but also you need to lose some. So you can't just fight about everything. You have to like know the things that are really important, because a lot of things will just take care of themselves. The producer whose sister is going to like build all your sets, like that's probably not going to happen, but they need to find that out. The only thing you can do in that sort of situation is to make sure that you pressure that job so that it falls apart before it really matters, so that they realize it's like, yeah, this person's incapable of doing this job. Now we'll hire somebody else. Or who was that you mentioned who could build sets?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're casting a movie, again, I mean, part of this, I guess, just is like sort of knowing people and knowing how to smell out BS and knowing how to like force something that's obviously BS into kind of imploding before it really just blows up the whole movie. You won't always succeed at that, but frequently you can. You know, they need to kind of learn some things. So there are battles you need to win. There's battles that, you know, somebody who's like, oh yeah, I'm going to do the music for this movie when it's done. It's like, who cares about that when you haven't even made the movie yet?
Right. Get there naturally, as opposed to forcing it.
Springsteen's a friend of mine, and he's going to come in. He's going to shoot this concert with him. It's going to happen. Yeah, great. You know, let them go work on that, and then let them let you, you know, work on the stuff that's really going to happen. So don't you can't win all the battles, and you can't win all the battles up front all at once. So deal with what really matters, and you know, get those decisions compromise on the stuff that you have to. Don't sell out, but don't just fight just to fight.
Right, it's not a measuring contest, and it won't matter if everyone hurts each other's feelings.
Yeah, and if somebody's out there like literally swinging their dick or something, it's like let them do it. Don't kind of get into that contest with them. You know,
exactly.
They need to be a big blowhard. It's like, let them just blow about that stuff, and then
let them hang themselves, as my manager often does, instead of adding fuel to the fire. And then
but a lot of problems will take care of themselves. They really will. So focus on what you need that day, you know, that moment during that
deal time. With the difficult actor or the cinematographer who's crossed the line, you know, tomorrow person, and say, don't do that again.
There's a certain, you know, talent is important. I think imagination is something that's not really understood by critics or people making stuff. There are certain people who just will never get it. They don't have the imagination to understand what you're trying to do.
Exactly.
But skill is like a huge thing that's more important, I think, than talent ultimately. And you get skill by doing stuff, which is why you should work on the other guy's movie. And watch what he does right, watch what he does wrong, you know. Because then when you're doing it yourself, you won't make those same mistakes. But you need to get skill, and that's something that, you know, you only get from practice, from doing it.
Bingo.
I think, like, filmmaking can be an art, but it starts out as being a craft. And if you do that craft well enough, then you sort of cross that, you know, it's not just a craft, it's an art if you do it well enough. But being a craftsman means that you're working a job, so there are like schedules and, you know, timetables and stuff you need to kind of stick to, and it means becoming skilled at your craft.
Bingo.
So that's
instead of saying I know everything and then rejecting a good idea because it's not me.
I meet people who are like songwriters and stuff. You see them on like America's Got Talent and stuff too, where they're like, oh, I've never sung anybody's song other than my own. Like, really?
That's a lie.
It's gotta be. But some of them, I think, are kind of, when they start writing their own music, they like don't want to perform other people's music. Or I know people who've written songs and weren't named yet, and somebody who's established will come to a show of theirs or hear a tune and want to buy it, and they won't sell it because it's theirs. You know, little Mr. and Mrs. Nobody won't sell their song to, you know, Lady Gaga or whoever. And I know people who've done just that. And later they all come to realize I should have done that, because you'll write more songs. And there's lots of performers who started out writing.
They might say, hey, man, you gave me my radio hit. I want to fund a spinoff band with you as the, you know, head honcho.
Right. And once you're the guy or girl who wrote that hit, then that opens up doors for you. You know, there's plenty of people. You know, Steve Martin started out writing on the Sonny and Cher show.
Yeah.
Which was not a little thing. He was a stand-up comedian who then like wrote for other performers. You know, he did stand-up, but his stand-up wasn't
exactly. People acted like he just begged Lorne Michaels to come on SNL. It's like, no. It took many different waves before that calling came.
Yeah, as far as films go, like, yeah, find people making a movie and go work on it. It also sort of say like being a professional is different than being a prostitute. I see people who don't understand that. You know, a prostitute will do anything for money. A professional will treat a job professionally regardless of the money. You give it a professional level of attention. You know, you treat it like it's real work, because it is real work. I hate when people come to me as like, well, you know, if you had a real budget, you know, this would be better. It's like, well, you know, I got you, so now I'm screwed because I hired you. You know?
Yeah.
So don't give me this, you know, I mean, I hate that. I don't hear that all the time. I hear it from people who are usually bad crew people.
Hopefully 2023 can iron out some of these guys who need some serious ironing.
Yeah, with time, wounds all heals. Yeah.
This has been a delight, ladies and gents. I'm actually about to rewatch your movie Unseen Evil on Tubi as we speak.
But the Invisible Monster movie. Yeah.
And there's been some good insight, because, you know, we need this kind of positivity instead of all this, you know, take my masterclass, find out. I'm like, whoa.
Oh, God. Is Michael Wiese still around? Does he still write books on production?
Probably.
Yeah, probably. I went and took one. We read his books. His books were good. It was a big thing in the late 80s. Michael Wiese had worked for these big companies writing a book about the business of film and all this kind of stuff. And then so me and my friend Dirk Ashton, who were going to make our own feature, I wanted to go see him in person and ask him some questions about all this stuff. And we drove to Boston, which was like a 12, 13-hour drive, stayed overnight, went to his thing. So, you know, you go to these seminars with these people. Wiese was basically like reading his book to you for a lot of money you pay. So he goes, okay, so, you know, we're going to take a break here.
Does he even really know the craft other than those notes he took, you know, back in 85?
Yeah. So, you know, he reached every 90 minutes, we're going to take a 15-minute break or whatever he was saying. So we reached the first one and he goes, okay, so this is our first break. Now, you know, this is a break for me too. So please give me time to go, you know, don't come up and ask me questions at the break. And then we knew we'd been wasted our money. You know, so there was no access to him on a one-to-one basis at all. If you'd read his book, you didn't need to pay money, you know, to go to that seminar and have him read it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that is the worst, because it's the interaction at those things is what you're going for.
Everybody, keep taking YouTube tutorials. Make good use of Rate My Professor. Don't just throw money.
No, there is somebody I would recommend, this Louise Levison, who's a friend of mine. Louise Levison. She wrote the business plan for Blair Witch Project, which is her lasting claim to fame and deservedly so. She wrote a book because she had come from the business world, got burned out on the sort of soulless nature of working for banks or whatever, and looked at like film production, was like, there's no books about bringing business plans to filmmaking. It's all about how to be creative and how to like make a movie artistically. It's not about how to put this into a pitch, into an organized way that somebody who's in business will understand and like, which also benefits you making the movie, because you're actually doing it as a business. So you're understanding payroll, and it's more complicated than that.
Right.
Writing business plans.
Totally subjective, but ultimately the business plan has to work. Yeah.
Right. If you're getting investors, you're going to need a business plan. And it was a very good book, which we used as a textbook for a production class we taught. at Bowling Green.
There was another business plan book that I think you were also featured in, and I definitely read a lot of it because it was just relevant. It's just like now, and it's still relevant. A lot of these indie books are still relevant, but I'm sure if I give it to someone, there's going to be still one snob who's like, oh, they're talking VHS. I'm like, just read it. It's the same formula.
Now
that you're working on a Microsoft spreadsheet, it's still the same deal.
Right.
Instead of just looking good in the interview, you still got to have some substance.
Yeah. Now there's the whole weirdness, of course, about crowdfunding. We didn't even really.
Yeah. And that got oversaturated.
And let's not, yeah. There's still some people who are pulling that up, but there's like a whole bunch of,
empty promises.
A lot of empty promises. You get a ton of like stuff forced down your throat, especially in terms of actors buying roles and things like this.
You're right. And they're not. And then people wonder, why is the movie not good? Oh, well, they thought about the script afterwards. Right. If you fund $50, I'll let you be one of the co-writers. Okay, that sounds more reasonable, especially if they're trying to do their own comic book or their own movie, and versus I'm the first five people get a Blu-ray. It's like, well, that might work for some who are still doing physical media. There's got to be something more than just I get merchandise.
Find people who are doing stuff and go crew on it. If it's the worst experience of your life, you're still going to learn a lot.
You really will.
And sometimes just shut up and listen. Don't be the loudest voice in the room, especially if you're trying to get a job. Like, listen to the people enough to kind of know kind of what they want to hear. But like, talk to people. Don't just talk.
Yes.
Yeah. And you can get to know people. It is who you know to a degree, but you can get to know people. You got to go to film festivals. You got to kind of put in the work, go to screenings and stuff and hang around before and afterwards. I helped clean up at this one company after their open house. And the whole company like went out to dinner afterwards. So I got to meet with the five top people at this production company and hang out for like 90 minutes just from going to their open house. Because afterwards I was like, hey, I'll help you take out that trash bag. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, that company. Yeah. Now, did that company make me rich? No, but I met a guy. From doing that company was going to buy a script of mine, which they didn't ultimately do. But through that, I met a guy who basically then led me to Courtney Joyner. It led me to basically everybody I knew in Los Angeles of significance for my first 5 years here. I met through going to that dinner because of one guy at that dinner.
Nice.
Because I said, hey, man, do you want to go to a movie? I was part of the Science Fiction Academy. And they screened stuff before it got released. It still exists, this academy. And so I had free movie tickets for movies that weren't out yet. Hey, man, you want to come? And you'd be surprised how many people say yes to something free.
You're right. What do you have to lose?
Yeah, exactly.
And if you're making use of that time while you're actually watching it, it's even better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This has been a delight, Jay. And
you're welcome.
I keep wishing the best for you because, followed indie filmmakers like you before back in the video store days. You guys would just come up at some of those convention scenes, and I just always applaud anyone who's just again stuck to their guns and just adapted through whatever medium.
It's been interesting. I mean, stuff I thought I would never, like commercials, all this kind of stuff. It's like stuff you think will never come back around, or you never
a fifth chance now.
Knowledge you accumulate, but you think it's like, well, I'll never need that again. It's like, well, I bet you will.
There's a fanboy out there somewhere.
Yeah, you're never gonna know. And most of my work has been work for hire. It was interesting coming to LA because I didn't really know how much of an indie film scene there was in Los Angeles.
Right.
Because there was a lot. There still is, although there's less production now because people go to Canada and other states and. But I really didn't, But now, I worked for real companies and I worked, for completely independent stuff in LA too.
That's a delight.
I hope to get back on some conventions and do some of that stuff again. I was in New Jersey a couple years at the big convention there and Austin now, and that may branch out into some other things. Beyond the Store AGFA now has for theatrical Beyond Even Stars showed at three different film festivals last year, and they sent me a check, which is great. Nice. Yeah, it's actually got a theatrical representation, and it's in there with like Fulci and Argento and Romero movies, you know, and like in the mix with these, you know, with my heroes, you know, growing up kind of thing.
Amongst your gods, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so AGFA, that's something I never thought, you know, Beyond Dream's Door, you know. They called me over the years wanting to screen it at some of the Alamo Drafthouse screenings. I never had a print. They're like, do you have a 35 print? I was like, dude, this movie was shot in 16. We never even cut the negative. But now it's been remastered to DCPs, and so now I have a real, you know. So, anyway.
I hope you get to go to a few other screenings of it. And
Yeah, I hope so, too. So yeah, that's my story for the moment.
All right. Godspeed to you. And
thank you.
Keep, you know, patting yourself on the back.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.